Ladies and gentlemen, if you could please take your seats and we can make a start. According to the clock here, it is 2:30 precisely, time to start. And can I welcome you all to the first of a series of Young Foundation lectures, which we're going to be holding over the next few weeks to accompany the launch of the Young Foundation. As you will see, I hope, from the leaflets on your seat, most of the work which our predecessors did and which we'll be doing in the future is pretty practical work, but there's also a long tradition associated with Michael Young of analysis and interpretation, a belief that if you want to change the world for the better, you also have to understand the world as well. And I've long benefited from Charles Tilly's work in making sense and explaining complicated issues. If you are interested, there is an interview I've done with Charles in this month's Prospect magazine. But he's also, I think, unusual in being one of the very few people who's not only interpreted and explained complex phenomena from history to the workplace to cities, but also has made sense of how we explain things, an interpretation of interpretations. And that's what he's going to be talking about this evening in particular. Before the end, I'll do a little bit of a plug. Some of you may have picked up leaflets for the new prize we are launching this autumn with the ESRC, Michael Young Prize for New Social Scientists. And there are various books on sale or on pre-sale. And we are, I should say, permanently on the lookout for energetic people to join us as researchers or interns and so on. And many chances, perhaps after the session, to leave your names with the Young Foundation staff around here. But I'd like Charles to take the floor now, and we'll have plenty of time, I hope, afterwards for questions and discussion about the issues raised. Charles.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here to make direct contact with the Young Foundation and its constituency, and to speak to you this evening. As Jeff Mulgan mentioned, knowing that this event was going to occur, Lori Taylor recruited me to appear on his broadcast, thinking aloud yesterday afternoon, coupling me with an ethnographer who studies taxi drivers in New York City, since I ride taxis at least and often talk with taxi drivers, I thought it was an appropriate combination. But he did something very clever at the beginning of this broadcast. That is to broadcast tapes of... Are we getting feedback on this or... All right, we'll carry on and hope that the bounce... All right, I'll step back. I'll step back a bit. My voice resonates. He had the very clever idea of taking BBC interviews of people on the streets here to explain what was going on in New Orleans, Louisiana. And people came up with marvelous, conflicting, but in ways coherent accounts. God was striking the infidels, the government had failed, and so on, through a series of reasons that are an important part of my topic this evening. In the case of New Orleans and the response to the hurricane there, in the first round, we already get snippets of how people explain to themselves what was going on. After a while, after a very long while, to the shame of American politics today, political leaders began providing accounts of what was happening in New Orleans, a natural disaster that the American people would pull together to relieve. And then, to your pleasure or pain, eventually, a series of technical experts will show up on the scene. Already, the hydraulic engineers are speaking about what caused the levees to break, for example, what caused that kind of flooding, how you could prevent it in the future. It will take longer for the social scientists to speak up, but you can be certain that there will be articles, dissertations, and then eventually, in the sequence that always occurs, books about the response to this catastrophe in New Orleans. Throughout this process, people will be giving reasons, and they will be changing those reasons, varying those reasons, depending on the audiences to whom they're speaking. That's my theme, but I begin with a parallel, not identical, but parallel disaster, also American-made, 9/11. The first observers simply tried to figure out what was happening. On the morning of 11 September 2001, at 8:19 a.m., flight attendant Betty Ong called American Airlines Southeastern Reservations office in Cary, North Carolina. She phoned from American Flight 11, which had left Boston for Los Angeles at 8 a.m. In North Carolina, Ong reached Nidia Gonzalez. Ong told Gonzalez that hijackers had taken over her flight, had stabbed two other flight attendants, had killed at least one passenger, and had sprayed her and others with a substance that made their eyes burn and gave them trouble breathing. At 8:27, Gonzalez relayed Ong's call to Craig Marquis, duty manager at American Airlines Operations Center in Fort Worth, Texas. About the same time, air traffic controllers reported that the flight had made a sharp turn south near Albany, New York. "They're going to New York," Mr. Marquis remembers shouting out. "Call Newark and JFK and tell them to expect the hijacking," he ordered, assuming the hijackers would land the plane. In my wildest dreams, I was not thinking the plane was going to run into a building, Mr. Marquis says. Veteran Operations Officer Marquis reasonably mapped the hijacking of Flight 11 into vivid previous episodes during which captors had demanded money, asylum, or release of political prisoners. They had grabbed the plane, he supposed, to hold the aircraft, its crew, and its passengers hostage for concessions. Continuing her whispered chronicle of events aboard the aircraft, at 8:38, Betty Ong reported that the plane was descending. Her call cut off abruptly at 8:44. The hijackers of Flight 11 soon proved Craig Marcus's reasons wrong. A few minutes later, Brian Gumbel was broadcasting for CBS News from Manhattan. He had just heard that an unidentified plane had crashed into the World Trade Center. Gumbel spoke to an eyewitness, Teresa Renault, who was watching the World Trade Center from her apartment at 8th Avenue and 16th Street, about 2 miles north of the center. "Approximately 10 minutes ago," reported Renault, "there was a major explosion from about the 80th floor. Looks like it's affected probably 4 to 8 floors. Major flames are coming out of the north side and also the east side of the building. It was a very loud explosion followed by flames, and it looks like the building is still on fire on the inside. Oh, there's another plane. Another plane just hit. Gasps, yelling goes the transcript. Oh my God, another plane has just hit. It hit another building. It flew right into the middle of it. My God, it's right in the middle of the building.
Renault.
Yes, yes, right in the middle of the building. That was definitely on purpose. Gumbel. Why do you say that was definitely on purpose? Because it just flew straight into it. When commandeered commercial aircraft crashed into New York's World Trade Center, Washington's Pentagon, and a Pennsylvania field that September morning, people across the world began asking for reasons why. Why had someone perpetrated this vicious violence? Why had they targeted the United States? Why hadn't American authorities prevented the assault? Observers quickly shifted from simply making sense of what was happening to seeking reasons for the disaster. Direct participants faced the double challenge of finding reasons both for the terrible episode as a whole and for the specific incidents they had suffered or witnessed. News reports crossing the Atlantic suggest that similar feverish searching for reasons occurred here after the recent London bombings. High officials rushed to the disaster scene and sought reasons for what they found. Sirens sounding and lights clashing, New York City Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik and two of his men drove over close to the buildings, where they saw people leaping to their deaths from the North Tower. Soon Mayor Rudolph Giuliani joined Kerik. The mayor called the White House, learning that another aircraft had hit the Pentagon, and that, with President Bush in Florida, the presidential staff was evacuating the White House. In the course of a widely praised press conference, later the same day, Giuliani placed reasons for the attack in context. Quote, I believe that the people of New York City can demonstrate our resolve and our support for all of the people that were viciously attacked today by going about their lives and showing everybody that vicious, cowardly terrorists can't stop us from being a free country and a place that functions. And we'll do everything we can to make that point. The reasons vicious, cowardly terrorists who sought to destroy the functioning of a free country dictated the proper reaction, calm determination. In his address to Congress 9 days after the devastating attacks of 9/11, U.S. President George W. Bush elaborated on Giuliani's reasons by identifying the culprits and associating them with villains across the world. Our war on terror, declared Bush, begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Fatal words, as you know. As World Trade Center observers searched for reasons, they followed an extremely general human routine. We might even define human beings as reason-giving animals. While by some definitions, other primates employ language, tools, and even culture, only humans start young, offering and demanding reasons, then continue through life looking for reasons why. Reasons provide organized answers to the questions, why does, did, should, X do Y? X can be you or me as you tell me why you arrived late for our rendezvous. Me as I explain my winning of the lottery. Or the hijackers who piloted our aircraft into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. X need not be a person or people. X can be God, evil spirits, Islam, communism, or just plain them. X sometimes means individuals, groups, organizations, categories, forces, or invisible entities. X produces Y. The World Trade Center disaster provoked reason-giving at multiple levels, including, why did the hijackers seize the aircraft and crash them into the towers? Why did the buildings burst into flames and collapse? In the case of a participant, why did I behave as I did? Why did we, whatever the we, behave as we did? In the cases of participants and observers, why did other people, whatever the we, considered as individuals or as groups, behave as they did? What causes terrorism? What causes violence in general? Seriously proposed reasons for 9/11 include Al-Qaeda fanaticism, misguided American foreign policy, peculiar characteristics of Middle Eastern regimes, collapse of a previously stable, if dangerous, world order, and more. All those themes sound quite familiar to me. Most of my own professional work involves sorting out reasons for political processes at a broad scale. Why revolutions occur, what causes democratization and de-democratization, why terrorism takes its many forms, and so on. Instead of sorting out such broad political questions, however, my talk this evening concentrates on the social process of giving reasons at the person-to-person scale. Reason giving turns out to be momentous at this scale as well. Giving of reasons connects people with each other even when observers might find the reasons flimsy, contrived, or fantastic. In uncertain situations, such as the World Trade Center attacks, most people first adapt reasons for what is happening from models they've already learned through interaction with other people. Available models vary dramatically from group to group, situation to situation, and relation to relation. Regardless of their context, however, reasons provide rationales for behaving one way or another and shared accounts of what is happening. They also make statements about relations between the people giving and receiving those reasons. Whether accidental witnesses or public officials, people do not give themselves and others reasons because of some universal craving for truth or coherence. They often settle for reasons that are superficial, dishonest, or, at least from an observer's viewpoint, far-fetched. Whatever else they are doing when they give reasons, people are clearly negotiating their social lives. They are saying something about relations between themselves and those who hear their reasons. Giver and receiver are confirming, negotiating, or repairing their proper connection. And to anticipate my punchline, that's what we're doing right now, even though the conversation is very one-sided. For the moment. Commonly given reasons fall into four overlapping categories. First, conventions. Conventionally accepted reasons for dereliction, deviation, distinction, or good fortune. My train was late. Your turn finally came. She has breeding. He's just a lucky guy. And so on. Second, stories. Explanatory narratives. Incorporating cause-effect accounts of unfamiliar phenomena or of exceptional events such as the Trade Center catastrophe, but also such as betrayal by a friend, winning a big prize,
or meeting a schoolmate at Egypt's pyramids 20 years after graduation. Third, codes governing actions such as legal judgments, religious penance, medical practice, or awarding of medals. Fourth, technical accounts of the whys in the first three, how a structural engineer, a dermatologist, or an orthopedic surgeon might explain fire damage inflicted by the 9/11 attacks. Each of the four ways of giving reasons has distinctive properties. Each of them varies in content depending on social relations between giver and receiver. Each of them, among other consequences, exerts effects on those social relations, confirming an existing relation, repairing that relation, claiming a new relation, or denying a relational claim. But the four sorts of reason giving differ significantly in form and content. Each can be valid in a way the others cannot. Conventions involve no pretense of providing adequate causal accounts. If I start explaining in detail why I spilled my coffee on your newspaper, how I had a bad night's sleep, have been worrying about my job, recently developed a tremor, it's hard to control, you may well become impatient. Oops, I'm such a klutz, may suffice, especially if I offer to get you a new newspaper. Conventions vary enormously according to the social circumstances. Given an identical dereliction, deviation, or good fortune, for example, a reason that satisfies a seatmate on the bus will usually not placate one's spouse. Conventions claim, confirm, repair, or deny social relations. They therefore differ greatly depending on the social relations currently in play. Exceptional events or unfamiliar phenomena, however, call up different reasons why. They call up stories. People experiencing an egregious failure, a signal victory, a spectacular faux pas, a shared tragedy, or mysterious sounds in the night do not settle for "it was just the brakes." They too try to match reasons to the circumstances and social relations at hand, but now the reasons take on weight. Similarly, major life transitions such as marriage, divorce, or the death of a parent call for weightier accounts than conventions provide. In general, reasons for exceptional events complement explanations with at least hints of justification or condemnation. The company gave me a bigger bonus than you because I worked harder and sold more computers. Implied claims concerning the quality, intensity, durability, and propriety of relations between givers and receivers far exceed the claims tied to conventions. Stories matter greatly for social life because of three distinctive characteristics. First, they rework and simplify social processes so that the processes become available for the telling. X did Y to Z conveys a memorable image of what happened. Second, they include strong imputations of responsibility and thus lend themselves to moral evaluations. I get the credit, he gets the blame, they did us dirt. The second feature makes stories enormously valuable for evaluation after the fact, and helps account for people's changing stories of events in which they behaved less than heroically. Third, stories belong to the relationships at hand, and therefore vary from one relationship to another. A television interview gets a different story, interviewer gets a different story of a lost football match from the one that players tell each other. Stories truncate cause-effect connections. They typically identify a limited number of actors whose mental states and actions cause everything that happens within a limited time and space. The actors sometimes include supernatural beings and mysterious forces, for example, in witchcraft as an explanation of misfortune. But the actors' dispositions and actions explain what happened. As a consequence, stories inevitably minimize or ignore the causal roles of errors, unanticipated consequences, indirect effects, incremental effects, simultaneous effects, feedback effects, and environmental effects. They conform to dominant modes of storytelling. In fact, most of the early reason giving for 9/11 took the form of stories. In contrast to stories, coded reasons need not bear much explanatory weight so long as they conform to the available rules. When I served the U.S. Navy as a rule-wielding supply and dispersing officer, veteran Chief Petty Officer Edward McGroarty, who helped train me on the job, used to joke, "There's no reason for it. It's just policy." Religious prescriptions, law codes, and prestigious systems of honors overflow with reasons. But those reasons describe how what happened conforms to the code at hand, rather than what actually caused the outcome. Third parties, such as judges, priests, and awards committees, figure extensively in the giving of reasons according to codes. Finally, technical accounts vary enormously with regard to internal structure and content, but they have in common the claim to identify reliable connections of cause and effect. Structural engineers center their cause-effect connections in mechanical principles. Physicians in the dynamics of organisms. And economists in market-driven processes. Although engineers, physicians, and economists sometimes spend great energy in justifying their expertise when under attack, earnestly demonstrated that they reached their conclusions by widely accepted professional procedures, thus following codes, on the whole, they center their reason giving on putative causes and effects. Whole professions and organized modes of professional knowledge stand behind them. After half a century in the business of explaining political processes, especially various forms of collective violence, I naturally have my own technical accounts of terrorist attacks to tell, as well as my own evaluations of other people's technical accounts. Here, however, I want to shift our attention to an adjacent question. Assuming that we social scientists actually have something valid and useful to say about social processes, how do we get them across to dubious audiences that have no training in social science, yet are quite committed to the reasons they give for their own and other people's behavior? When crises occur, governments often answer the question by appointing credentialed panels on the model of a British Royal Commission to promulgate the best available specialist explanations or prescriptions. 4 years after the Warren Commission reported its findings on John F. Kennedy's assassination, for example, President Lyndon Johnson appointed another commission. He charged the new commission with responding to the ghetto rebellions, rising violent crime rates, raucous demonstrations of the 1960s, and the 1968 assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy. as well as the widespread concern that America in general was becoming more violent. The so-called Eisenhower Commission faced an even more daunting task than the Warren Commission. It enlisted help from more than 200 scholars in law, criminology, history, and the social sciences. I did my small bit by contributing an essay comparing American and European patterns of collective violence. We scholars who participated counted it a victory that the commissioners did not adopt a stern law and order line. Instead, they recommended opening up opportunities for minorities and youth, giving young people more political voice, and using financial gains from ending the Vietnam War to increase American welfare benefits. They reasoned that inequality and stifled opportunity caused violence, individual and collective. Commissions continue. On Monday, the 31st of March, 2003, the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States held its first public hearing at the Alexander Hamilton U.S. Customs House in Manhattan, New York, not far from the leveled site of the World Trade Center. At that hearing, commission members Governor George Pataki of New York, Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York City, the city's police commissioner, Raymond Kelly, multiple survivors of the 9/11 attacks on New York and elsewhere, representatives of the victims, and academic experts on terrorism all testified. Testimony at the first hearing approached the vicious violence of 11 September, 9/11, from many different angles. When it came to giving reasons for 9/11, some witnesses offered conventions, some codes, some stories, some technical accounts, and some more than one kind of reason. In the well-staged drama of commission hearings, we see very general processes unfolding. We watch participants not only giving and receiving reasons, but also negotiating their relations as they do so. The topics of terror and governmental responsibility raise the stakes of contests over reasons. But also allow us to see what happens when people care seriously about the consequences of giving one reason or another. We began with people seeking reasons for the devastating attacks of 9/11. Few of the first round reason givers, as we saw, offered technical accounts. At the time, most people who were immediately involved gave reasons in the form of stories, while others who stood at greater distances chose among stories, conventions, and codes. In their simplest versions, the three ran something like this. Story: terrorists did it, but lax officials let them do it. Convention: modern life is dangerous. Code: because we have freedom to defend, we must combat terror. It took longer for specialists to construct their technical accounts. Those accounts ranged across many different questions, especially how airplane crashes brought down supposedly unshakable buildings. What went wrong with American intelligence, why those particular attackers attacked, and more generally, why terrorist attacks occur at all. Public officials who spoke before the commission mostly told stories. So did survivors who testified at the hearing. People asked the why of death, destruction, or disappearance. People asking those questions often press for stories in which some person, entity, or force will bear moral responsibility for a devastating action. Indeed, the 9/11 Commission came into being partly because of public pressure for stories. As the government slowly and reluctantly began inquiries into how it might have prevented 9/11, demands for convincing stories inevitably arose. a group of New Jersey women, widowed by the attack on the World Trade Center, began pressing public officials for an inquiry. They got advice from veterans of the earlier campaign for an inquiry into the bombing of Pan American Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, in 1988. They played a major part in forcing the commission's public hearings on the government's own preparation, or lack of it, for terrorist attacks before 9/11. You can be sure that we'll have parallels to this with Hurricane Katrina and the governmental response. The women explained their involvement to a New York Times reporter. Quote, three of them were married to men who worked for Cantor Fitzgerald, but the women were strangers until after the attacks. Ms. Breitweiser, 33, and Ms. Kazatsa, 43, voted for Mr. Bush in 2000. Ms. Van Auken, 49, and Ms. Kleinberg, 42, voted for Al Gore. All insist they had no political agenda then or now. But they had a burning question. We simply wanted to know why our husbands were killed, Ms. Breitweiser said. Why they went to work one day and didn't come back. Clearly, for them, an acceptable answer would not take the form, terrorism happens. When Mindy Kleinberg testified before the 9/11 commission she had helped create, she made her position clear. Quote, is it luck that aberrant stock trades were not monitored? Is it luck when 15 visas are awarded based on incomplete forms? Is it luck when airline security screenings allow hijackers to board planes with box cutters and pepper spray? Is it luck when emergency FAA and NORAD protocols are not followed? Is it luck when a national emergency is not reported to top government officials on a timely basis? To me, she continued, luck is something that happens once. When you have this repeated pattern of broken protocols, broken laws, broken communication, one cannot still call it luck. If at some point we don't look to hold the individuals accountable for not doing their jobs properly, then how can we expect terrorists not to get lucky again? The question called for a story that would assign political and moral responsibility for the catastrophe. After the 9/11 Commission issued its report in 2004, Kristen Breitweiser echoed Mindy Kleinberg's call. Quote, 3,000 people were killed on 9/11, she complained in a September 2004 interview, and no one has been held accountable. By the presidential elections of November 2004, 9/11 survivors, including the New Jersey widows, had formed a pressure group called the Family Steering Committee that was publicly criticizing the Bush administration for failing to support the commission's recommendations. The story had gone political. The commission's experts, as expected, concentrated on accessible versions of technical accounts. With due simplification for a commission consisting not of specialists, but of public figures, Swedish-born Magnus Ronstorp, international relations lecturer at Scotland's St. Andrews University, presented a technical account of terror. Ronstorp's account of terror initially divided causes into proximate and longer term. His proximate causes centered on the current organizations and capabilities of Al-Qaeda and other terrorist networks. His longer-term causes consisted of changes at a global scale that facilitated terrorist activity. Later, Ronstorp enumerated a third, even more basic level of causation, root causes of terrorism. They included unresolved ethnic and nationalist aspirations, poverty, and youth unemployment. But he focused his recommendations on ways of monitoring blocking and dismantling terrorist networks. He concentrated on countering the proximate and intermediate causes of terrorism. Social scientists who build general technical accounts of terrorism divided their attention among the three levels of Ronstorp's analysis: proximate causes in the form of organization and tactics of terrorist networks, longer-term causes centered on the facilitation of terror as a political strategy, root causes such as generators of grievances and discontent. My own small contributions to the public discussion concentrated on longer-term causes, but argued strenuously against the ideas that most people who employ terror resemble al-Qaeda's conspirators, and that most or all terrorist attacks spring from the same causes. Expert testimony before the 9/11 Commission suggests a powerful lesson for technical specialists. Instead of making specialists out of your audience members, translate your message into a form they will already grasp. That isn't always easy. People who draw their lessons, their reasons, from complex codes or technical accounts must choose between two alternatives: educating their audiences in the relevant bodies of thought, or pushing their expositions toward popular discourse, toward conventions or stories, depending on whether the reasons involved concern propriety or cause-effect explanation. Physicians, lawyers, theologians, and other specialists who must deal regularly with members of the general public usually become skilled in converting codes and technical accounts into less forbidding forms of reason giving. Of course, high authorities such as a Supreme Court or a group of Prize-winning Nobel physicists can announce their findings and leave the conversion to other people. Despite intermittent challenges, most Westerners have come to accept the claims of high courts and nuclear physicists to superior knowledge, or at least within those specialist domains. Some bodies of specialized knowledge, furthermore, have acquired enough prestige and urgency that schools teach their codes and technical accounts. Although natural scientists and mathematicians deplore the general population's ignorance of their specialties, at least schools make an effort to teach students the fundamentals. Pity the linguists, anthropologists, and economists whose special forms of reason giving most students don't encounter until they go to university. Here's one solution for specialists who lack the commanding presence of high authorities: rework your teachings as superior stories. Like everyday stories, stories simplify their causes and effect. They maintain unity of time and place, deal with a limited number of actors and actions as they concentrate on how those actions cause other actions. They omit or minimize errors, unanticipated consequences, indirect effects, incremental effects, simultaneous effects, feedback effects, and environmental effects. But within their limited frames, they get the actor's actions, causes, and effects right. By the standards of a relevant and credible technical account, they simplify radically. But everything they say is true. Superior stories make at least a portion of the truth accessible to non-specialists. Social scientists face a distinctive problem when it comes to getting their arguments and findings across. The social sciences carry on a complex courtship with stories, conventions, and codes. They claim to describe and explain the same social processes that non-specialists habitually treat by means of conventions and stories. Hence, a bundle of problems for social scientists. They're commonly proposing explanations of the very same behaviors and outcomes for which people learn early in life to give accounts in the forms of conventions, stories, and codes. Social scientists' very evidence often consists of reasons that people give for their actions. Yet social scientific explanations frequently contradict conventions, widely available stories, and/or prevailing codes for actions. Worse yet, social scientists' proposed explanations often involve cause-effect accounts of why people give the reasons they do. As researchers, authors, teachers, and participants in public discussion, social scientists therefore find themselves causing an offense and cultivating disbelief. In any case, they rarely reach general audiences with their technical accounts. When they do get through, it usually happens through one of three standard approaches: making visibly effective interventions in public life, for example, opinion polling; broadcasting the logic of social science, for example, newspaper columns on economics; or infiltrating public discussion by providing valuable catchwords or arguments, for example, the idea of the lonely crowd that David Riesman once made famous. But on the whole, social science's technical accounts stay within the academy, unheard by the general public. Shouldn't social scientists simply emulate fields that have already found ways of communicating with lay audiences? After all, engineers, physicians, theologians, and other specialists who routinely seek their own explanations within technical accounts then often communicate with clients and lay people by reworking those accounts as stories. Converting technical accounts into stories makes it more likely that the listener will understand and accept the account. But what if some social science, scientific technical accounts point to crucial cause-effect relations that don't lend themselves to storytelling because they involve incremental, environmental, reciprocal, simultaneous, or indirect effects? No one can, for example, explain how international migration streams operate without paying attention to the subtle but powerful impact of previously existing interpersonal networks on who goes where and gets what job. Most social processes involve similar complexities. Their explanation requires full-fledged technical accounts, but social scientists often have trouble making their accounts credible. Might deliberate campaigns to disseminate plausible superior stories work? Social scientists have had somewhat more success at infiltrating available explanatory stories than at visibly effective interventions or at broadcasting the logic of social science. Some of them have, for example, publicized the argument that if whole categories of people suffer systematic disadvantages, some combination of discrimination with distinctive life experiences, rather than, say, some crippling incapacity shared by all the category's members, accounts for those disadvantages. Here, social scientists enter the arena as public intellectuals rather than as designers of pedagogy. Books, the mass media, and public forums provide the crucial opportunities. In this version of reason giving, social scientists have little choice but to recast their technical accounts as readily recognizable stories. Such stories can never encompass all the relevant cause-effect relations. They can never incorporate the full range of incremental effects, environmental effects, indirect effects, reciprocal effects, feedback effects, and unanticipated consequences. Much less can they enumerate all of the professional's crucial specifications concerning initial conditions and contingencies. But at least superior stories can get right the cause-effect relations they do include. That in itself constitutes a valuable contribution. Let me not exaggerate the uniqueness of social scientists. Philosophers, theologians, cosmologists, biologists, physicians, lawyers, and generals face similar problems when they communicate with general publics. They all mix and match among four main alternatives. One, speak only to fellow specialists. Two, educate some members of their audiences in their specialized codes and technical accounts. Three, recast their reason giving in the form of superior stories. Four, count on translators and interpreters who already speak the language to do the recasting. Speaking only to your fellow specialists is the easiest, but it runs the risk that other people will misunderstand, misrepresent, or simply ignore whatever you're doing. Educating audiences in your specialty is a wonderful enterprise if you have the power and skill to do so. Depending on translators and interpreters, science writers, popularizers, and knowledgeable amateurs, saves plenty of grief when the translators and interpreters know their stuff. But for a wide range of specialists, writing your own superior stories has the virtue of making you think about the relevance of your daily work to humanity at large, or at least the humanity with which you make contact outside of your study, laboratory, or conference hall. Even when it starts with technical accounts, reason giving doesn't end with writing and lecturing. Physicians and lawyers regularly have to translate their own technical accounts into stories their patients and clients can understand and act on. As they do so, they're establishing, confirming, negotiating, or repairing their relations with patients and clients. The reasons we give shape our relations with the people who receive them. We can also read my analysis in the opposite direction. The reasons people give you reflect their approaches to relations with you. Most of the time, conventions and stories confirm relations that you already knew existed. You instantly recognize the wrong convention or story, which claims a relationship you prefer not to acknowledge. When someone offers you codes or technical accounts in unfamiliar idioms, you rapidly choose between two interpretations. Either this person has misunderstood the relationship between you, or she is claiming superiority and demanding deference by virtue of esoteric knowledge. If, of course, you've asked for a summary of the relevant codes and technical knowledge, you've already established the inequality of your relationship, at least for the purposes of this conversation. A clever, sympathetic interlocutor can shift the relational balance by pushing the account you have asked for toward conventions and stories. Giving reasons does a wide range of social work. That work always includes shaping the relationship between giver and receiver of reasons. I hope you find my story superior.
Okay, we've got about half an hour for questions or comments or strong disagreements, or indeed better stories. There are microphones there. We are almost exactly 2 months after the bombings on the London Underground buses, and I think the stories of making sense of those have not settled down yet, even if we don't have inquiries as on the other side of the Atlantic. And since we're in the London School of Economics, it may be worth mentioning a book which came out some time ago by, I think, a man called Robert McCloskey, an economist who then actually had a sex change and became, I think, Deirdre McCloskey, but called The Rhetoric of Economics, which explained many of the most influential economic theories of the last 50 years as having had their impact because of their narrative structure as stories, not because of their scientific proof, which was quite a challenging thought for the economics profession. Who would like to kick off with a question or comment? I say we have microphones down here and upstairs. Yeah, up there at the back.
Hi, Professor Tilley, I wanted to ask you, you've mentioned different categories of reasons that people give, and let's take any one of them, say, what you call stories. My question is, how are there mechanisms or how and why does it happen that people move or change from one story that they accept to another? I know it's a very broad question, but perhaps you can shed some light.
Well, there's, as in so many such cases, there's a simple answer which is more or less true, and then there are great complexities. The simple answer is that relations change and therefore stories change. And all you need to think about is how people give accounts of their lives so far to different people. And you realize that no one ever tells the story of a life the same way twice. Now, that's partly because of fallible memory, partly because of boredom. There are some other things going on. But part of it is that if you tell me the story of your life, or at least a truncated version of it, my response is signaling to you, first of all, whether I think you are telling me something that I could accept, and second, something about our relationship. But if you tell the same, if you somehow get to recounting to the story of your life, to the love of your life, you are likely to put it together in a very different way. You are negotiating the relationship as you shift the story. Now, it is also true that people shift from one type of reason giving to another, for example, from a convention to a story under certain social circumstances. For example, I forget completely that I was supposed to do something for someone else. I was supposed to put in a good word for this person. How I explain that dereliction depends on whether the person is someone that Roberto Franzosi, my friend in the fourth row here, recommended to me but I've never met, or my brother. I will provide, that is, simply saying, well, you know, it was a busy time, will not satisfy my brother. It probably wouldn't satisfy Roberto either, but I could more easily use a convention in a more distant relationship than in a closer relationship. Now, there are a whole series of variations of that kind. It's not the only thing going on, of course, but one of the major things going on, and the main point I dwelt on this evening, is that the reasons given, and even the types of reasons given, signal what kind of relationship the giver and receiver are establishing or negotiating.
Could you just follow that up, though, the question about why people accept a different interpretation? So, for example, people might at first interpret terrorism as being caused by evil.
Mm-hmm.
And then what is it that might take them to a different, perhaps more sophisticated, but still story-based interpretation?
Well, we talked about some of the devices that do this. For example, one thing that does happen is that authorities themselves back one story or another. I mean, I may think that evil spirits caused the pain in my left hand. I have no pain in my left hand. I'm imagining this right now. But caused the pain in my left hand until I take it to my physician and he points out that I have a sprain of some kind. I mean, this is a silly example, except that it illustrates a move from my own evaluation, my folk evaluation, or what might prevail in my family, to an authoritative person. This is incidentally a very serious problem in the connection between local medicines and Western medicine through much of the world, as we find people who have perfectly adequate explanations for their purposes of what causes what we see as the symptoms of AIDS, and find very strange the explanations that representatives of the World Health Organization bring in as they attempt to install preventive measures of one kind or another. As a matter of fact, friends of mine who work in the field say that frequently people who are repeatedly interviewed by representatives of the international epidemiological community learn two or three discourses. That is, they learn what the health people are looking for, so they learn how to give reasons within the Western medical tradition, but they continue to treat and to explain within another code, because in fact they have competing authorities. In South Africa, a Sangoma gives you one view of what is causing your problem. It might be witchcraft. And a physician gives you another interpretation. So one of several processes by which people change their reason giving is contact with authorities who provide them not necessarily with more adequate, but with more legitimized stories about whatever the condition is.
Question down here.
Thanks. You seem to be arguing that social scientists should be spending more energy on telling superior stories. But I wanted to raise a question of incentives. If you're a lawyer or a priest or a doctor, then it's actually a very crucial part of your work to communicate with non-specialists. If you're a social scientist, it's a much less important part of your work. There may actually be disincentives if you start making mistakes by being too crude. You may get frowned on by your professor or whatever else. I work for Oxfam, and a lot of what we do is translating. We do the translation function, and it's really frustrating how few academics find it worthwhile to tell stories in a public and accessible way. Have you got any ideas about how the incentive structure can be changed within social sciences so that people are rewarded for talking sense?
Possible.
Well put. Yes, as a matter of fact, social scientists are just as jealous of fame as other people. And if in fact we could teach social scientists not only to be good social scientists, but to be engaging social scientists as they present their work, that is to make them poets or playwrights of the business, then the response of a public, even the mild laughter I've been able to evoke this evening, becomes a further incentive to do a better job with the story next time. I'm having a little trouble standing on my toes and not spitting into the microphone, but okay.
Matter of fact, can you hear me in the back row?
Yes.
All right, then I'll not use a microphone.
Is there truth and can we know it? Because you seem to be implying that everything is about relationships and fitting into people's assumptions and blah de blah. But don't people, aren't we kind of sort of not stupid and able to piece together things? I mean, someone, when the Reichstag fire happened, people who hated the communists went, oh, it was that crazy Dutch communist that did it. But evidence came in and now no one believes that. So I feel like I'm a little worried that you're kind of leaving out the possibility of at least approaching the truth.
Well, I believe deep. I wouldn't be in this business. I write poems all the time. I I would be a professional poet if I didn't think that what was at stake in the work I do is some version of truth. My view is that there are total untruths, and then there are things that are not so untrue, and that it is possible to distinguish between totally false views of how the world works and somewhat better views of how the world works. In my own line of work, I have never come across anything which was an absolute truth, which said, no one will ever be able to refute this summary of how this works. But I think it's quite possible to distinguish between degrees of adequacy, both from the point of view of description. This is this is a robust description such that you can draw some inferences from it, and if you hit it from the side, it will shatter, or something like that. And that it's possible to do something quite similar to that for cause and effect. That is to say, here's an intervention that allows us to say, your account of cause and effect is terrible. There's simply no connection between the cause you allege and the effect you allege. Here's one that looks as though it's more robust than that. Here is an account of terror, notably ambiguous, mushy subject, that is better than this other account. For example, in that vein, there are a series of accounts which say terrorists are, and then there's a universal statement, which is usually about the mental condition of people who carry on destructive acts. All such statements are false because they apply to some and don't apply to most. But it is possible to specify the conditions under which terror becomes a feasible and even attractive strategy to different kinds of political groups. My explanations will probably have disappeared 20 years from now. There will be better explanations. But what we're dealing with is degrees of approximation to adequacy with respect to description and explanation. Sure.
Hi. Just fundamentally going back to the original question, which is, I'm just having trouble pulling some strings together. Why do things happen? And I think what you did was say, you know, this is how people evaluate things, and this is how they put them into categories, or how they explain things. But then how does social change happen due to the way, I'm assuming this is all about how social change takes place, or how social change is explained. Or am I missing a point somewhere here? I'm just trying to understand, like, how does social change, how is it impacted by the way we behave to reasons?
Well, you're a victim of our hype, I'm afraid. You see, we lured you in here with a more ambitious title than I could possibly fulfill. But every circus entrepreneur knows that trick. I tried to take one part of that question, which is how do people ask and answer the question, and bracket all the rest. So I didn't offer you, and did not even claim to offer you, despite the title, a general account of how and why things happen. Now, we could have talked about how regimes change, for example. I don't believe that there is a general phenomenon, say, equivalent to the phenomenon of cheese, which is called social change. You know, and then we can say things about all social change. I do think there are processes such as urbanization, migration, economic expansion, war, democratization, revolution, and so on, about which we can make coherent statements. And it's my business most of the time to deal systematically with such processes. But what I was trying to do here this evening, under, I agree, slightly misleading pretenses, was to say, what are we doing when we ask that kind of question? And then to pull out only one part of the answer, which is what we're doing in a relational way. What it has to do with the relationship between the reason giver and the reason receiver. That's maybe 1% of what I should have said to fulfill my sponsor's name for the lecture.
You can read the books, of course, which do answer the main question.
When you said that the reasons we give shape our relationship with the people we give them to, and that's a very interesting statement. But when we in Africa, for instance, we try to analyze why we are suffering, why there are wars and all these things, and then we say, if we say it's as a result of an exploitation by the North of the South, North-South relation, that is usually dismissed as conspiracy theory and is not taken seriously. And secondly, the preemptive reasons America gave to the world to attack Iraq, have they changed the world, the relations? Have they changed the way the whole world now view America? Because when they attacked Iraq, they said Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, which were not found. Iraq had a link with Al-Qaeda, which was not established. Iraq was better off without a bad dictator, Saddam Hussein. Of course he was, he is. But he was not the only one in the Middle East. So all these, have they changed the relationship? Have they changed the way the world view America now? And are people who are questioning those preemptive reasons right? Thank you.
You actually have answered your own question, but let's spell out the answer to the question. First thing is the deaf ear of many in the North to Southern claims of exploitation is precisely a description of the relationship. I certainly did not claim that every time I give you a reason, you accept my reason and somehow conform to its implications. What I said is, we're negotiating our relationship when I give you a reason. The case of Iraq, there in fact are very serious consequences for precisely the, dare I say, reasons that you gave. Because the discovery that there were no weapons of mass destruction, the discovery that toppling Saddam Hussein was insufficient to bring on a glorious democracy in Iraq, and so on, through the explosion of the claims that the United States, or at least our president, made in making war in Iraq, discredited the position of the United States. It changed the relationship between the United States and many client states throughout the world. So it seems to me a brilliant exposition on your part of how reason giving changes relations.
How successful do you think Al-Qaeda have been at getting others to adopt their reasons for their actions?
Al-Qaeda was briefly successful, I would say, but in fact, first of all, the network itself seems to have shrunk radically since 2001. And while there were many emulators temporarily, the Al-Qaeda center seems to have lost its importance in the attacks on Western countries that have occurred since that time. There's still connections, there's still some sponsorship, but in fact, here I certainly was wrong, because I had thought that with the sensational example of the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, that there would be many more emulators in 2002, 2003 than actually occurred. Now, I can give my reasons for being wrong and defend myself by saying we now know how long it took to prepare the attacks of 2001. The fact is that most of the agents were already in the United States in 1999. So they had recruited and prepared the network that was in place for several years before. This is not something that a small group can emulate without something like the financial and political networks of Al-Qaeda. So that it's a little bit, I suppose, like the World Bank. It's very hard to emulate if you don't have the resources.
I sympathize with the adherence to stories. Everybody loves a good story. It seems to me that one of the questions hovering behind your talk is, why do we disagree about why things happen, and what do you do then? And in that context, I mean, obviously many of the problems we are dealing with now at a global level are big, systemic, complex, climate change, economics, migration, terrorism. And telling a story involves, as you said, selecting certain causes, certain effects, and also certain moral principles. And those stories then, as we've seen in many cases, become incommensurable and stop talking to each other. So what do you do then?
You get engaged in politics. No, not necessarily politics with a capital P, that is the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, or something like that, but in fact, you get involved in struggle. That is, you may simply polarize and never speak again, or you may engage in, Aristotle talked about it, rhetoric, that is a process of incorporating your companions' arguments in your own, transmuting them, or, as often happens, I gave you an instance, you may appeal to some third party who has greater prestige and it says, all right, that's the story. But now you've confirmed in a way that, first of all, that I omitted the stakes in some sense. I mean, I did say something about the stakes of stories and conventions and so on, but I didn't place them in the larger question of how is it that people make moral sense of their lives? I quoted the New Jersey widows, for example, and there they are demanding a complete story. It's not simply that they want a plausible story they can tell their children. They want justice. They want fairness. They want completeness. They want to close this process of mourning in some way. Simple storytelling, however engaging, will not solve that problem. But I think you've made a point that perhaps I didn't make sufficiently, and that is that when they engage in reason giving, people are also simultaneously negotiating moral positions, and sometimes, often, they cannot reconcile the moral positions that they're taking. Now, it occurs to me that this is a dilemma for social scientists, among others. I think of my friend Adam Ashforth, who is currently in South Africa. He's been working on AIDS and witchcraft in South Africa for some time. And there's a problem. I mean, I bounced off the problem indirectly earlier. There's a problem, and that is that the accounts of AIDS in South Africa
generally involve, that is the accounts that people give, generally involve witchcraft. Witchcraft is a fact in South Africa. It's a relational fact that you can't blink. And yet, the Western-trained scientists and the Western-oriented politicians who deal with this fact have great difficulty bringing witchcraft into public discourse. And what's here, what we have is two competing technical accounts and story systems clashing with each other. It will take a rhetorical or political genius or both to figure out a way to recognize that ordinary people afflicted with the consequences of HIV will commonly look for that person who has caused a spell to be cast. Does that mean that the physicians in the business should become sangomas? Certainly not. It does mean that there's a problem of reason giving, that a simple assertion of medical authority is not going to solve. Now, this is an extreme one and very worrisome in South Africa because people are dying and refusing treatment that would at least extend their lives as they turn to anti-witchcraft interventions. But it's actually a version of something that happens all the time in the universe you're calling our attention to, where people don't arrive at a reconciliation of their stories.
There's a question in the fourth row, so at the front there.
Professor Stilley, I would like you to draw a parallel between Katrina and the tsunami in light of the fact that many of the American newspapers exclaimed that Katrina is their tsunami, yet the aftermath was provoked very different reactions. The wave of sympathy that was seen in the tsunami is not the same that you see in Katrina. The kind of rioting that you see in New Orleans did not happen in South or Southeast Asia, and I'd like you to reflect a little bit on that.
Yes. Now, we're actually going to have to differentiate. For example, there was more panic reaction in Banda Aceh than there was in South India, for example. And there are some substantial regional differences in the reaction to the tsunami that we would have to take into account if we were going to do a detailed study, just as we would have to compare New Orleans with Biloxi with some other hard-hit parts of the Gulf Coast of the United States, and that would be an important matter for our technical account. But perhaps the most important way, the most salient way, at least to put it, is this: the initial devastation wrought by the tsunami in South India, along the Indian coast and out into the islands, was as serious as the damage done in New Orleans, but in fact, very rapidly, both local and national safety nets began to work in India. In fact, it's a great humiliation for the United States, if anybody finally makes this comparison, that India, supposedly bumbling large democracy riven by Hindu-Muslim conflict, etc., etc., provided a much more effective response to a similar emergency than occurred in the United States. Now, if we went to Sri Lanka, we would discover a somewhat different situation because we would find that the Tamil Tigers and the dominant Sinhalese engaged in a deep political battle over how aid for the tsunami would be administered, struggling for who would be recognized as the true authority in Tamil dominated territories. So there's a variation, but the contrast between India and the United States in this regard is a very serious blow against the adequacy of the United States as a welfare-maintaining state today.
And what might be the explanation for that?
well, now you're into our politics. I mean, that is, as the gentleman in the first row suggested, the United States has concentrated so much of its resources, including its defensive resources, on a view epitomized, organized in the Homeland Security Administration, that we are defending ourselves against external enemies, and we will do so by armed force of one kind or another, that we've drained resources away from other forms of prevention. So that I'm sure that when the inevitable commissions form in Congress and elsewhere over the Gulf Coast destruction, one of the things that we will talk about a great deal in the United States is the depleting of funds for the Federal Emergency Management Administration, FEMA, which was supposed to be in charge of such events, but basically got downgraded and subordinated to Homeland Security in the current administration. But we will also discover, I mean, this is already coming out and will be matter for political struggle in the United States, that the Army Corps of Engineers, which is the basic agency charged with managing waterways in the United States, lost funds for its maintenance of water control along the Mississippi, Lake Pontchartrain, and in the Gulf Coast. Now, I gave you an hour on reason giving, and you understand that there will be a great many people looking for things that could have happened, or proposals that somebody made in 1999 that would have prevented, et cetera, et cetera. There'll be a great deal of second guessing, but I do think that we will see a massive depletion of American capacity to deal with domestic devastation as a consequence of the diversion of resources to war.
Explanation offered by our Prime Minister to the event of 7/7 as a consequence of evil and perverse interpretation of Islam. What category would you put that explanation into? And what does that say about his relationship with the people of this country?
I think you're probably a better judge of the answer to the second question, but I'll say the first question, it sounds as though he had listened rather too much to George W. Bush. And that vocabulary was readily available. And as a matter of fact, I think in some ways politicians are victims of the last success in this regard. Both Giuliani and Bush, Giuliani the mayor of New York and Bush, had given very similar analyses of the 9/11 attack, and to universal applause, perhaps even here. I'm not sure whether you applauded, but in fact, it was a very effective performance. I mean, I immediately went, here's an example of political ineffectuality, or what intellectuals do in circumstances like this, but I immediately went to my electronic mailing list and sent out rebuttals. They got nowhere. Those were extremely effective speeches. And so that model was available to Tony Blair for 7/7.
Professor Tillich, may I possibly move you from the specifics into a more normative sphere? Two questions. One is, I heard in your talk about the stories quite a lot of the reference to cause and effect. Did I mishear that?
No. I think, as Aristotle thought, that stories provide explanations.
Okay. Now, the other one is, and I won't say why I'm not necessarily terribly happy with that, but the second one is, how and in what way do you see the normative side linked with the work of Professor Lakoff and the work on metaphors?
Sorry, whose work?
Professor Lakoff.
Oh, I see. Yes. Metaphors people live by, men live by, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I don't think this contradicts Lakoff. It simply says, let's look at how people actually organize their use of these metaphors. I mean, as I read Lakoff, people are more likely to be captured by the metaphors than to be active users of them. If he and I were debating this, I suppose I would be on the side of human agency, and I would say, look, people have available to them a wide variety of stories. They're creating those stories, and they're not simply victims of the metaphors that are available. They're actually constructing, and that's partly as a consequence of the relations that they're building. But you didn't quite get to this point, but it seems to me it's closely related. At the same time, stories are a great vehicle for fixing responsibility. She did that to me. She's responsible. I lost my job, and so forth. If I haven't done much eavesdropping on the underground, but I have to ride the New York subway fairly often, and I must say that by a rough count, something like half of all the conversations I hear, as I listen carefully to my neighbors on the subway, consist of this kind of moral discourse in which people are saying, often bosses, incidentally, you know what he did? And what I had to do? This kind of storytelling, fixing of responsibility, is a central human activity. And to that extent, it has a strong normative edge.
So let's take one last question right at the back there.
Okay. First of all, Professor Tilley, I have to identify myself as another victim of the fancy title, since I was really excited about the prospect of hearing how we come from 9/11 or will come eventually to urban riots. allow me to try and follow up from a couple of previous questions, focusing on some points that you've made. I think that you said that there is nothing essentialist about social change. However, at the same time, you said that the process of reason giving is quite important to social change, maybe instrumental to it, exactly because it is the process of negotiating of two agents engaging in a negotiating process of their social positions. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the hidden keyword here would be the word trust. I am willing to accept you as, in a way, socially superior, as an expert on an issue, because you come here and you give brilliant reasons to explain, to account for a social phenomenon. So I assume the position of a student, and I accept you to assume the position of a teacher. Now, if this is true, I wonder what would be the case if you came to the LSE to give a public lecture and you said something stupid. I if I may venture my story on this hypothetical example, I would say that people would start whispering if they realize that you said something which is simply not correct or not true, and would gradually, if not instantly, lose trust in you as an expert, as an authority. Now, if this is true again, I find it quite hard to understand how you replied to a previous question that 9/11 the fact that weapons of mass destruction were not found in Iraq changed, in a sense, the way things stand in the United States or here. The last time that I checked, George W. Bush was president of the United States again, this time reelected without the intervention of the Supreme Court. Tony Blair is still the prime minister here, quite comfortably so. And my question, just to make it clear, would be, when will urban riots occur?
I never said that enough change had occurred. And I certainly don't claim that every time someone's reason giving fails, instantly people discredit the giver. Sometimes people go back. My children came back to me over and over again for reasons, even when I turned out to be stupid or wrong, because they didn't have much choice. I was their father. The process you described is one that the American sociologist Irving Goffman described beautifully. He called it rim talk. He said, when he was discussing the idea of a frame, he said, all right, people create a shared definition of what's going on. But when discrepancies appear between that shared definition and what people are observing, around the rim of the conversation, they start doing the equivalent of whispering to each other. Maybe they literally whisper to each other. Is that what he said? And at a certain point, rim talk accumulates into rebellion. So what you should be watching for is how populated the rim of this conversation is.
There's a microphone just behind you.
Right, thank you. I can't quite understand what cause and effect is from your talk. Is there any relationship between the law of karma in Eastern philosophy, which is also described as cause and effect?
Short lecture on karma.
Is there any similarity at all?
I would say my conceptions of cause and effect are very Western. Yours is at least a dual question and probably many layered. But if you're asking me what's my conception of cause and effect, it's one of a fairly straightforward, efficient cause. I can give you a more detailed account, but I imagine that we can describe the intervening events that uniformly connect an initial intervention of some kind to some outcome, and that we can see that there are mechanisms. That's what I call such a sequence. We can see that there are mechanisms that are extremely general, and that to identify the causes of something is to specify the mechanisms that produce this joint outcome. But it's by no means the only theory of causation that people hold in the world today. There are many theological conceptions of causation which are quite different, and the idea of karma, that is, to the extent that it has to do with some connection with the character of the universe, the cosmos, is a different, perhaps not competing, but at least different understanding of what cause and effect is. But I was using a fairly conventional, simple notion of an intervention that you could imagine duplicating an intermediate set of events and an outcome and a uniform link among those elements.
Well, I'm afraid the LSE clock is now at 4:10. We are in a slightly different time zone here for reasons I don't quite understand. I'd like to thank Chuck for giving us what's really been an intellectual workout, different ways of thinking about the world, but also thinking about how we think about the world. And perhaps when you read the newspaper tomorrow, you'll see it in a slightly different way. It does link very much to the prize I mentioned earlier. Any of you here who are social scientists, please take one of these leaflets, which is about the Michael Young Prize, which in a way is premised on belief that the world is comprehensible, that there are better and worse explanations, that the best ones are usually based on observation, not just thinking about things. But if you have them, it's good to try and share them with a wider audience. And this is in part about helping to share good insights with a wider audience. I hope we'll see some of you at the lecture next week by Tariq Ramadan, and the week after by Ali Hochschild. And finally, can I thank you for being a very good, very smart and interesting and thoughtful audience, as well as our speaker, Chuck.